Thank you very much. Well, good morning. I'm delighted to be with you once again. And I must say at the get-go, I'm very impressed about the two books that were chosen this semester. It speaks of not only your maturity, but the depth of your hunger and yearning to truly live out your own spirituality. So I'd like to begin with a poem written by a wonderful pastor named Ted Loader in his book, Gorillas of Grace. And this particular poem has a very engaging title. It's called Guide Me Into an Unclenched Moment. Guide me into an unclenched moment. Gentle me, Holy One, into an unclenched moment, a deep breath, a letting go of heavy expectancies, of shriveling anxieties, of dead certainty. That softened by the silence, surrounded by the light, and open to the mystery, I may be found by wholeness, upheld by the unfathomable, entranced by the simple, and filled with the joy that is you. So I'd like to change and work with the title that we've all been, I would say, struggling with about confronting racism. So today I'd like to work with it this way, confronting and transforming racism. So let's start from a theological basis. To truly understand this work, we have to not only recognize, but to own the fact that this is both a psychological and a spiritual work. They cannot be separated if we are truly to transform racism. Psychological in that this is a human work. A human work. We can't escape our humanity, our own limitations, our life story, our life experiences. It's a spiritual work in that we're not alone. And indeed, the Creator is at one with us, prodding us, prompting us, guiding us, sometimes pulling and pushing us along. This wonderful back and forthness is meant to energize and empower us, to alleviate us of unnecessary baggage of excessive fear and laziness to move forward. Because fear and lethargy are the true enemies of any growth in this area, any transformation. So here's the theological statement I'd like to make at the beginning. That is that we are created in God's image. Created in God's image. We know this is right from the very first book of the Hebrew scriptures. Certainly affirmed deeply by our own Yeshua of Nazareth, our own master teacher. What we often forget is there's also a collaborative invitation through that wonderful gift of being created in God's image. And it's this, we're called to grow in God's likeness. And our model is the Christ, Yeshua of Nazareth. What that means practically is that like God, like the one that we call the Trinitarian, unifier of love, we too are called to become co-creators, co-redeemers, co-inspirators, or if you find that last word hard, co-guides on this journey called life. So the wonderful gift that's been given to us through Howard Thurman is he embodies this becoming, growing in the likeness of Christ. And just to summarize what I know you've all heard and seen through the videos and various speakers, but remember it was Howard who modeled for us someone who was a creative theologian, is that he was willing to creatively take another look at how do we worship. Many of us that come from the Indo-European cultural backgrounds, we were told to keep very still when we worship. But those from the African continent, they cannot sit still when they worship. They got to move those bodies. And so in Howard's great wisdom, he brought this together in bringing dance and body movement and music and the arts in such a way that it expanded people, that helped them to honor and respect the fullness of their humanity. He also embodied someone who studies, not just once, getting a degree, but continues to study all throughout his lifetime. Desire to want to grow, to improve, to learn, to expand consciousness, awareness, his understanding. He also learned through silence and nature that God is beyond the temples that human beings built. And he invites us to see that each one of us had the capacity to have a direct experience of the divine. It's not just for those that we call mystic, like himself, those who are living a monastic life, those who are living a vowed life. It's for every human being. He also, by his very person, invited us to follow him in crossing racial and religious divides. The thing that I found very affirming is that he readily admits he was influenced by others. He didn't just come up with this by himself. So his own mentors, his teachers, people like Rufus Jones, Gandhi, his wife, on and on, is that through this wonderful community of believers, people who are doing their own psychological and spiritual work, he then began to learn the deeper message of the Christ. And so I'd like to be able to unpack these chapters for you and to bring in some of Kendi's work as well. For me, as I read these two books, what I liked about Thurman's wonderful insight is that I have a propensity, a leaning towards philosophy and theology. It was like he really fed my mind that way. But you know, Kendi challenged my heart. Every single chapter was going, ooh, that hurts. Oh, that's me too. Oh no. And it's like, after a while, I'm gonna put the book down and say, okay, that's enough. Every single chapter just hit me right in my solar plexus, deep in my heart. So brilliant choices that these two books are meant to really confront our way of thinking, our way of feeling, and together our way of doing. So I would like to dip into literature and remind us of some lessons that can help us in this journey of unpacking Thurman's wisdom. As we look at Shakespeare's wonderful creation of Hamlet, the lesson that we can learn from the story of Hamlet is that in the end, only action will redeem us, not stasis or in between. There is such a temptation after reading these two books together to say, wow, that was a powerful time together. I learned a lot. And subconsciously say, thank God I'm done with that. And not willing to do the real work. And the real work is to do what Hamlet learned. We are to get our rear end moving, to do something different. We rarely think ourselves in a new way of acting. And Thurman reminds us, as does Kendi, that we have to act ourselves in a new way of being. Secondly, as we looked at T.S. Eliot and his wonderful work of Proof Rock, the lesson we can learn from this figure is that it's better to muddle through what's going on and risk taking than to remain in suspension. In other words, receive the virtue of courage. We desperately need that virtue in this time when there's so much fear and paranoia that's driving so many people to the extremes of human life and society, both in the church, society, in our personal relationships. Because Christianity suffers most, as does any religion, when it's divided. The third lesson we can learn from literature is from Sophocles, the famous story about Antigone. Lesson that we learn from Antigone is this, that in the midst of the paralysis of fear, we are still summoned to be persons of valor and value. In other words, there's no excuses. If we feel small and weak and insignificant, not an excuse. We are still called by the Creator to valor and value. So if we deny this action, this invitation, and these great creators of this literature point out to us, then what will happen is, sooner or later, the interior life is going to demand payment. Sooner or later, the inner life is going to demand payment. Then we're forced to repair within. So this is an echo of what C.G. Jung talked about many years ago near the end of his life, when he was asked, did he have much hope for human beings? And his answer was, no, I don't. Not unless they're willing to work with their shadow. Not unless human beings individually and collectively are willing to do their inner work. If not, the shadow overwhelms us. As I reflect upon the social reality that we are living in now, I really believe that's what's going on, is that really nothing new has happened other than the fact that no longer we're not being nice. We're not coming over all this work. And racism is a very clear component. It's only one small component of this whole area. So where in the world did all this come from? How did it all start? Well, this is my offering to you in this regard. As human beings, we began early on, thousands of years ago, to seek one another out to form what today we'd call tribe. This is where we got our identity. You know, I belong to this tribe, not that tribe. And that we live supporting and encouraging and nourishing and caring for those members of our tribe. This tribalism carried over for many, many centuries. And so many different religions just kind of supported this and encouraged this. Jesus even gave a quote from the Hebrew scriptures about continuing to love your tribal members with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to hate your enemies, those outside the tribe, with much energy. Well, then several centuries ago, we began to move into what is called nationalism. Nationalism is just a larger view of tribalism, you know. Now it's everybody who lives inside this territory, our territory, often won at the price of many, many horrible battles, real and imagined. And so it's where we get identities like, well, I'm Italian, or I'm German, I'm Irish, you know, I'm American, okay? And it's just a larger form of tribalism. Well, now we're in a period where there's a real edge because there's still people who do not want to move out of tribalism, nor nationalism, the call, the invitation to move to globalism, to see ourselves as earthlings, as a part of this one planet. Anytime there is a movement of pushing us out of our comfort zone, there will be violence. There will be people who want to dig in their heels, refuse to grow, refuse to look at, what am I afraid of? I don't want to do this work. How can I escape this, et cetera, et cetera. But I would offer you this reflection. I believe the Creator is calling us to a completely different time, a time of wakefulness and transformation, a time of wakefulness and transformation. What that means is that we're willing to look at creation, which of course includes us, but includes all God's people, all God's creatures, all God's planets, all the cosmos, with new eyes. New perspective. And Thurman hits it right, the nail on the head. It's with the eyes of love. The eyes of love. Without that, we're going to try and remake these individuals, these creatures, this earth, this cosmos in our own image and the way that we want it to be. But we need to recognize that the Creator often sends to us the very people that we don't like, that we don't want, the very experiences that can help this transformative work, but that we fight and scream. Why? Because we want to be comfortable. You know, the only time that Jesus speaks about comfort is he speaks about comfort to those who have been deeply wounded, traumatized, disinherited, marginalized, unaccepted by the majority. That's when he speaks about comfort. So, in effect, if we can take Jesus' words and twist them around, blessed are those who are willing to struggle with the discomfort of being human. Because that's what this work is all about. It's about growing in the fullness of life. Remember, Jesus said, I have come that you might have abundant life. He never said, I've come that you might survive. Those who are disinherited very often are kind of pushed into that particular arena Just trying to survive, make ends meet, not be killed, not be harmed, not be destroyed, either in terms of reputation or literally. So how do we do this? Well, for the rest of the sharing, I'd like to offer you some ways that we can actively engage these three different aspects, fear, deception, and hate, that are the enemies of growing in this work of love, this transforming work of love. So let me begin with a reminder from New Testament scriptures. You know, Jesus was fully human, and that meant that he too was limited in his experience of how he interacted with other human beings. And so he grew up in a culture that taught him that, listen, you need to identify and connect and be faithful and loyal to your tribal identity as a Jew, as a first century Palestinian Jew. Of course, he did that. As he began his public ministry, and it wasn't that this didn't happen before, but it just became more apparent when he was in public ministry, is that he also was confronted with non-Jews, what today are called Gentiles. If you read the four different stories that are so transformative, you'll notice that each time Jesus at first rejects the request. One story, he says, you know, why are you coming to me? You know, you're not a Jew. But thank God the Syrophoenician woman was a feisty woman and spoke right back to him. All four, he says at the end of their interaction, I have not found this much faith in all of Israel. In other words, amongst his fellow Jews. And for all four, he granted them the request. In the end, the message is that even Jesus had to change his perspective about this whole closed-mindedness, but his call. It was for all humanity, not just those like him. We who are Christian then have been immersed or baptized into that same message, that our faith, our life isn't just for people of our own denomination, not just for those that carry the banner of Christian, not even just for those who are American Christians. It's for all people, for all people. 3 years ago, I had the privilege of being able to go on a walking pilgrimage from Porto, Portugal to St. James place up in Spain. And it was a phenomenal opportunity to walk the faithful journey that had been going on since the 8th and 9th century. And the experience was profound in many ways for me each day, as a matter of fact. But one of the great memories and gifts I received was the very last day, and that was being in the cathedral. And in this cathedral, they close the doors to everyone else except those who've been on the pilgrimage. And then we celebrate Eucharist. My companion, Father Patrick Mullen, and I decided to go to the 7 p.m. Eucharistic liturgy. And there during the sign of peace, as I was seated in the assembly, I was offering people sign of peace all around. We could hear the different languages. And I turned around and behind me was a huge throng of people. I put my hands up and just yelled out, peace be with you. And in that moment, there was this profound heartfelt insight that came. And it was what I would call a voiceless voice saying, these are all your brothers and sisters, just like your own biological family. Now, I was very touched by that, but the real grace was that memory, that experience was so imprinted upon me that as I went home to America, everywhere I looked, I sensed God saying the same thing. But what really got me was the continuation of that lesson. Even the people you disagree with, people you don't like, people look different than you. We often forget that from the Christian perspective, we use that term brothers and sisters is to remind us that we're all a part of God's forever family. And so when we do not accept that, we fight, rant, and rail because somebody believes differently than us politically, or is a different denomination, or God forbid, doesn't have faith, we treat them like they're pariah, not welcome. So this particular pattern can play into the hands of the evil one, because the evil one is always about separating and dividing. And that's where the word diabolical comes from. It means to throw apart, to separate. And God's plan is for unity. God's plan is about unifying. Those of you who married, you know this by your experience. Your sacrament is the only sacrament that was given before the fall. Is it possible that's God's way of saying, beginning, in the middle, and the end, my whole work is about unifying people, helping people to understand that everything belongs, that everything has a place. So when we somehow or another want to run from this truth, we find ourselves stuck and we lose sight of what the real work is meant for us, the real work. So I'd like to dip into depth psychology now and to give you three lessons that were given to me through the lens of James Hollis, recognized depth psychologist, of what can help us in this time with this particular topic of confronting and transforming racism. First insight from this field is, it's not really what it's about. It's not really what it's about. Okay? So I'll give you three little subsets of this. Whenever we get ill, or when a body politic gets ill, we are to not just look at the symptoms, but look beneath the symptoms. What's the real cause of what's going on? So I would offer you for this reflection, the symptoms of racism go to the very root cause of fear. Fear, a very basic human emotion that we share with animals, creatures, okay? In the lowest part of our brain. Now, in the field of depth psychology, in our nightmares, our dreams, the shadow appears for us white people in either dark clothing or dark colored skin. Okay? Is it possible that in our own naivete, simplicity, fundamentalistic approach, that we've translated that into our conscious life, and that we've demonized or, quote, colored a whole group of people that have a skin color different than us, for those of us, again, who are white? Certainly something to think about. A second aspect of what it's not really about is dealing with the stuck places in our own life. Dealing with the stuck places in our own life. So where do you find yourself emotionally stuck, or intellectually stuck, or physically stuck? Rather than fighting against it, why not ask a simple question? What's the meaning of this? What am I supposed to learn from this? No? When I was ordained a deacon, I purposely asked to be sent to inner city, in what here in Los Angeles is called South Central Los Angeles, and it's predominantly Black. And I knew in my conscience I needed to deal with my own racism. And I wanted to face this issue. This particular parish, St. Cecilia's, at that time was about 70% Black and the rest Latino. So I was there only for a short time, for a summer. And I thought maybe I might teach some scripture. So this particular group of women primarily asked if the class could take place in the home of one of the women. I said, sure. So I go thinking I'm going to teach all these people about the Gospel of Mark. And we agreed on a 4-week course. I walk in and they explain to me, now, Deacon Jim, you get 1 hour. That's all you get. That's our turn. I said, oh, okay. So for an hour, I unpack the Gospel of Mark, in quarters. And at the end of the hour, what was going to happen? What? They said, you stay here. And all the women got up and they left and went to the kitchen. And out they came with homemade food. Homemade plum wine, pies, meat. all from their southern background. It was indescribably delicious. Now, none of them asked any questions during the hour when I was, quote, teaching, but they could not stop talking during the time we were eating. The real lessons of the scripture came out in sharing the meal. I thought I was going to bring Jesus to them. Boy, was I wrong. I was so humbled and humiliated as I sat there realizing they're bringing Jesus to me. I had it all wrong. It was backwards. The entire summer was a wonderful heart awakening for me. I was stuck in my own judgmentalism. The third subset is, you know, the reason in our country we're struggling so much with addictions and compulsion, because it's a safe harbor for addictions. And the reason we can't get over them is because the addictions aren't what it's all about. The addictions really is like a huge stop sign. It's like saying, look at the addiction, whatever it is, if it's about addiction about sexual activity, addiction about alcohol or work, or addiction to drugs or gambling. There's a whole list of them, codependency, all of it. At its core, addictions and compulsions are all about being stuck in a place that we're not willing to look at. Hidden inside every addict is a misguided mystic, That's what we're running from. The symptom is an addiction, a neurotic repetition over and over and over again, trying to wake us up to say, listen to what you're really seeking. What's it really about? When people come to confession to me that struggle with repetitive sins or failure, they say, well, what are you really seeking? They don't understand it. I say, well, what do you think is at the core of your sin? And when they can't name it, I say, well, go back and do it again until you get it right. Figure out what it's about. Because embedded in every sin, shortcoming, failing, addiction, compulsion, call it whatever you want, is a deep, purposeful meaning or statement that's meant to wake us up. There's that word again, to wake us up to the depth, is that the divine is hidden in the human. Did you hear that? The divine is hidden inside of you. It's God's favorite place to hide. The second truth that we can receive from depth psychology is what you see is a compensation for what you don't see. What you see is a compensation for what you don't see. So there are two things that we often hear in counseling that come up. One is overwhelmment, the other is abandonment. Let me explain that real simply. Many of us suffer from being overwhelmed, okay? And the most common thing is being overwhelmed by life, by what we call power complexes. In other words, feeling weak, insecure, I can't do this, this is beyond me, I just don't know what to do. And this overwhelmment can lead to an overreaction, you know, a stronger than life pushing back. And we saw this, for example, during the last election cycle and during the last many years. And I'm not just talking about the Donald Trump era. We've seen this for at least a decade and a half. But to recognize and to see what's really going on, that we're compensating for something that we don't see. Sometimes within an individual or a group, there can be the paradox of moving from being overwhelmed to feeling abandoned. And the abandonment comes from a low self-worth. The thing that I'm not there yet. Deep insecurity, you know. I must admit, as a Catholic, I get so frustrated with my fellow Catholics because we often joke about, you know, this, but the feeling of I'll never be able to live into my own divinized nature because I'm a sinner. That's the complete opposite of what Jesus taught, is that actually when we choose to focus on the sin or the low self-worth, we are closing our heart, our eyes, our life to the very Creator who says, would you stop focusing on yourself? Your life isn't about you. It's about the rest of life, about those that I send you. So what you see is a compensation for what you don't see. And often we can do this where we can overcompensate. If I feel insecure, for example, well, I want to get a job that has a title, you know? Or if I feel insecure, then I want to be able to work 80 hours because then people think I'm really smart or I'm really a hard worker, you know? And we all find different ways of overcompensating, feeling like we've been abandoned. The abandonment can start, we feel mostly abandoned by one or both parents, abandoned by a lover or a spouse, good friend, betrayed, or feeling overwhelmed by life. We overreact and say, well, okay, I'm going to keep repeating the same activity over and over again. A woman who feels like they have that super clean house, you know, or to always be well manicured, okay, or the man who has to always have the newest in fashion, okay. The third deep truth from depth psychology is that all is metaphor. All is metaphor. From my perspective as a religious leader, I think this is perhaps most important out of all three, at least in terms of a maturing in the very areas that we're talking about. Let me just tell you why. First off, to live the symbolic life is to live the religious life. This is why Jesus spoke in metaphors, using symbols, symbolic gestures, parables. All of these were to help train people. If you want to know deeply the core truth or meaning or depth of the kingdom of God, you've got to do it through metaphor, because the soul's language is metaphorical. Soul's language is metaphorical. We get to understand this, for example, through dreams. We understand this through active imagination, and why things like intuitions, ailments, stuckness, strong emotions, okay, history, jokes, stories, all of these are given to us as metaphor. It's the soul's language of trying to wake us up to come on the inside. What Kendi did in his book is he told his story. He didn't let himself off the hook, and that's why it's so attractive, why it's so scary. Because every chapter he's saying how he got sucked into the racism, how he struggled with his life. He also recognized why he did it this way. You know what a very famous philosopher said, and that is, the personal is the gateway to the universal. The personal is the gateway to the universal. That we tell our story of our struggle. That's why you hear me when I preach and teach, I do it all the time. And not because I want you to be another Jim Clark, it's because I say, well, here's my story. Here's how I tried to do it or how I struggle. You can do the same thing in your story. So another way to touch and deepen the metaphorical is to trust your own internal messengers. Trust your moments of meaning in the midst of your own great struggle and pain. When the light goes on, you say, oh, I get it. Oh my gosh. Trust your deep feelings, your own energy systems inside of you. What gives you life? What moves you to feel grateful to be alive? What connects you with other human beings? What helps you to celebrate who you are and what you're about? One of my students at LMU, young Black woman, gave me a wonderful gift that was painful. And I told a story, which I won't tell you, but I told a story in class about an encounter that I had between an Asian chef and a Black client in a restaurant. And it did not look well for the client. And she asked to speak to me at the break. And she told me very honestly and humbly how the story, the way I told it, really offended her. And I must admit, for the life of me, I wrestled with it afterwards. It's like, I didn't quite understand where she's coming from. But in my language, what she was saying is, what you did is you told it in such a way that the entire lesson portrayed every Black person. It took me quite a while to get that message. And I realized after meeting Kenny, that's exactly what I did. I was wrong. I was wrong. Is that we can tend to group everything around one story. That's not what the story is meant to do. It's meant to open us up, not shut us down. So Rilke, his great poetic wisdom, says it lovely. He says, our task is to be defeated by ever greater things. Our task is to be defeated by ever greater things. That one story I told was defeated by that courageous young woman who came to say, could you rethink the way you tell your story? She was right. And that's what we're talking about in terms of racism, is that racism is a small challenge in terms of the bigger challenge of how do we relate together as human beings. Human beings, that's the bigger task. It's how do we come together? Not as well as I do, that when tragedy hits, when trauma hits, we don't start thinking about, is that person Asian? Are they Native American? Are they Afro-American? No? Are they Latino? They're a human being. We reach out to them. You know? Or perhaps you've had the wonderful privilege of having intermarriage in your family. There's people of other culture, different storied backgrounds. And to recognize that rather than it being a struggle, that it's meant to be an invitation to that greater thing of how are we to be human together? So the three enemies to this becoming human are deception, fear, and hatred. Fear is very simply the unwillingness to look at the deeper truth. And this is where we can make it a point, a personal action, to say, I am afraid, and then to name it. Because what we often do, because we're social beings, is we look for support. In other words, well, I'm afraid of such and such, so I'm going to look for other people who are afraid of that and say, yeah, we all are. That's when we begin to get a larger and larger group. People have to say, well, those people or that situation, yes, you need to be afraid of them. This is why we tell jokes. We can't just tell a joke by saying, well, there was this man walking down the street. We say, well, there's this Italian man, okay? Well, there's this black guy, you know? And we laugh because we've already had an innate bias either for or against certain groups of people. So that's another idea, is to take a look at how we tell our jokes or how we gossip, you know? Who ends up being, quote, the bad person the joke is about? Or the good person. Isn't it interesting that in the old cowboy movies, quote, the bad guy always wore a black hat. And oh my gosh, if you're a black man, they made it even better. You know, he's really bad, you know? Again, tapping into that shadow sense. And of course, the good person was always wearing the white hat, okay? So Thurman points out that the real penalty of fear is that it disconnects us from our inner self. Our inner self. We project out our fears onto others because I'm afraid of what's inside me. I'm afraid of what's inside me. This is extremely helpful to understand this. I know as a young man, I was terribly afraid of my anger. I was afraid if I started to express it, that I would explode. And the reason being was, my dad was a rageaholic. My mom denied her anger, and I was caught in the middle as the oldest son. And I'll never forget the gift of this big, tall, he was built like a fullback or a defensive linebacker, big, tall black man who helped me go through a ritual. And I won't go into all the details, but he said to me, as I'm screaming at this group of men, because I felt like they really set me up for this ritual. And he said to me, deep voice, Jim, we believe you. And then with that, he pulls from behind him a 4 foot long, tall mirror and says, this is the man who has to believe you. what a gift this man gave me, because I looked at my face and I was just filled with anger. My face is all red, but what grabbed me was my eyes. My eyes were bluer than blue and they were focused. And that healed me. You know why? Because when my dad was enraged, his eyes were unfocused. They were all over the place. I knew intuitively he was dangerous when he got to that point. We had no idea what he'd say or do. But I knew, looking at my face, I knew exactly what I needed to do and what I wanted to do. It was then that I could embrace my anger. And that man was a messenger. A messenger that helped me to face. Because he wasn't afraid of his own anger, he could stand there watching this white guy go nuts. And that's what we're talking about. The second one is deception. The penalty of deception is to become a deception, to live life in inauthenticity, to lose sight of oneself. And we've seen this, especially in the last 5-6 years, where people now consider it, not only is it okay, it's a good thing for you to lie all the time. Big lies, small lies. And when we do that, there's no sense of who one is. You lose sight of who you are. Amongst the Aztecs, they had a saying, whenever you greeted another Aztec in the morning, you would say to them, "Don't lie." And the response was, "I won't lie, but don't you steal." That was their normal morning greeting. Fascinating, isn't it? And so that's one of the reasons why when the Spaniards came, they did both. They lied, they cheated, and they stole. They didn't know how to handle that, because in their culture, truth and honor of one's property, one's person, were the highest values. And these so-called Christian people, soldiers, completely violated. As you well know, those are two of the clear Ten Commandments. So deception comes in many guises. To recognize what we're called to do is what Jesus insisted on, and that is to simply, directly, truthful, whatever the cost. That he insists on this. Because when we're not, we lose sight of who we are, we stop being human. We stop being human. So as Thurman says so beautifully, humankind's relation to other human beings and human beings' relation to God are one relation. That when we forget this, as believers, we are terribly, unnecessarily divided. The last one is hate. Hate. You know, I must admit, I agree with Thurman completely, this is the one emotion that believers do not like to talk about, honestly. And it's one that we do need to talk about. In my family upbringing, my mother would not allow us to use that word. We would get our mouth washed out with soap if we use that word. I hate so-and-so. Or I hate you, especially if that was against our parents. So as a result, we learn as little kids that we have no idea what that means. Just we know that it's a strong emotion. Mom doesn't want to hear that. So I know she didn't mean this, but it taught me to push down strong emotions. And that's what's happened. And Jung is right, is that hatred is now okay. It's come out. But here's the danger. It's unprocessed hatred. It's coming out like vomitus, you know, ugly, smelly, difficult to deal with. You can't wash it away. It's like, oh, God, what do you do with it? But like any emotion that's denied, repressed, pushed aside, it never comes out in the way you'd hope would come out. It comes out in ways that are almost uncontrollable. So, yes, of course we're ashamed of hatred. Thurman's absolutely right. We're ashamed of it until it can be validated or given prestige by other people. And that's what the former president did. He validated the hatred and gave it prestige that other people were looking for. The gift that Thurman points out is, as with any repressed emotion, is that it's energy. It's an energy system. And that, like any energy system, it can be transformed. Racism can be transformed. It can be transformed into what is called a positive violence. In other words, a positive movement. I'm calling it, using the word transformation. When we're not willing to truly make it a point of reaching out, of recognizing that I can't do this alone, of humbly saying, you know, I hate to admit it, but I really struggle with so-and-so or this group of people. To find someone who can truly help you listen through it to the message of what is being asked of you through this emotion. What is a way that you can tame it? Now that you're owning it, how can you tame it? So Thurman wisely lists four ways that we could do it. First, he talks about creating context of fellowship. I know when I was assigned with Paris that was predominantly Latino, many of the English-speaking folks wanted to leave. We started working with a particular program where every single time we came together each week, we came together to share a meal and to share worship for about a half hour. It's amazing how it began to break down barriers. The women would start to share recipes. People would start to notice commonalities. They would ask, well, how do you say this word in Spanish? How do you say this word in English? You know? So that's what Thurman's talking about. Secondly, is to develop an understanding. Develop an understanding. When I was at St. John's Seminary, we had several different cultures. And I felt like a student. I'd ask, now in your culture, what does this mean? Okay? How would you do this in your culture? So to practice growing in a sympathy of saying, why do you do such and such? What does it mean? Third, is to take a look at the times we express ill will towards another. What's at the root of it? Is that if it's not addressed, it can be expressed in much stronger language or embodied actions of hatred. So the call that Jesus gives us, of course, call to love is the central commandment of the gospel message. That is that we're to love God with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to love each other, love ourselves. This is not just meant to be repeated automatically, but what does that mean for you, for me, the details of our life? Every one of us have different enemies. We don't call them such. We call them difficult relationships, or we don't talk to that side of family. You know, or no, I don't want to deal with that. But be that as it may, we are told that we are to ground ourselves in human dignity, as Thurman says so beautifully, but a dignity that requires us to forgive as we're forgiven. Because in doing that, we are living out the message, not only the good news, but the message of confrontation and transformation of anything that denies our humanity or the humanity of anyone else. So we're going to send you off into a breakout room. And I think the question is going to be written up for you. But if not, here it is. Yeah, there it is. Okay. So what larger thing in life is seeking to defeat you at this time in your life in order that you might experience a more authentic, loving life? Okay. What larger thing in life is seeking to defeat you in order that you might experience a more authentic, loving life? We'll see you in a bit.
Sounds good, friends. We'll come back in about 15 minutes for some more conversation with Jim. They're open now.